Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
Tonight's Shmooze refreshments as well as the CDs are being sponsored by Stolbeck2005.com in appreciation to Hashem for getting him to the end of the campaign for the Rockland County Executive Office. We wish Richard Stolbeck a lot of hatzlacha. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky used to use a mushal to explain something that people would make a mistake about. Rabbi Yaakov says that a pair of tzitzits is supposed to cover rov of a person's body. When you're a child, rov of your body is not that large of an area. So a child's pair of tzitzits is small. If you would take that pair of tzitzits and put it on an adult, it doesn't fit. It's way, way out of proportion. Rabbi Yaakov says that's a mushal to how some people go through life. There are many issues that we learn as children, things in Chumash, Hashkafas, various things that we learn as a child. And then as we become adults, we don't review them, we don't revisit them. And then we find that there are many life situations that we can find answers to. There are many life situations that don't make sense because our Das Torah and much of the understanding that we have of the Torah has been formed and remains in a child immature level. Hence, it doesn't answer real life questions that we face as adults. And says Rabbi Yaakov, for many people, the way they go through life with their basic understanding of Chumash and the basic understanding of Das Torah is like a child's pair of tzitzits, and that's why they have a lot of problems. And I think it is incumbent upon us as mature thinking adults to oftentimes revisit concepts that we know, concepts that we've heard for many, many years, but to revisit it now with a mature understanding and see if we could learn what the Torah really means. Many of the concepts we're going to discuss this evening, we already discussed in Shmooze 69, but I'd like to bring a little bit more of an understanding to it. The Pasuk in Bereishis Perek Aleph says, Vayas Elokim Eshnei Hamoros HaGadolim, Hashem made the two large luminaries, the two large light sources, as Hamor HaGadol, the large one, L'mshela Sayom, to rule over the day, V'samor HaKotom, L'mshela Salayla, the small light source to rule over the evening, V'esha Kochavim, and the stars. Rashi points out the stira, the contradiction that the Gemara asks, and that is that the beginning of the Pasuk seems to say Hashem created the two large light sources, Shnei HaMa'orus HaGadolim. Then right after that, the Pasuk says, the Ma'or HaGadol, the large luminary, Vesamor HaKotan, the small one. Just a moment ago, you called them both large. Now all of a sudden, one's large and one is small. Says Rashi, that in fact is accurate. Shovim Nivro, they were created equal. They were both the sun and the moon were created the same size. Vinismata halavana, the moon became small. Al shekatra, because it complained ve'amra and said, yevshelishne malachim sheishtamsu bekeser echad. It's impossible for two kings to wear one crown. Therefore, Hashem said, you complained. Therefore, the moon is to be smaller. Now, when you learn this as a child, you understand that the moon complained. And Hashem said to the moon, you complained, you were jealous, therefore we make you smaller. But when you think about this Gemara that Rashi's quoting as an adult, you quickly realize that it's difficult to understand. The moon is not made of Swiss cheese. The moon does not have eight-headed dragons occupying it. The moon is an inanimate object made of rocks in total domain. And the moon doesn't talk. 12 men walked on the moon. Not one of them came back and said, we heard the moon talking. Yet Chazal are describing something in very, very vivid terms. But if you study the Gemara is even more explicit and exact in terms of what the conversation is. Says the Gemara that Hashem said to the moon, make yourself smaller. To which the moon says back, is that proper? Because someone has a good taina, has a good complaint, they should be punished. To which Hashem says back, you're right, I'll make it up to you. What's going to happen is you'll shine both in the evening as well as during the day. To which the moon says back, what does that mean? Can a candle be seen during the day? After all, I'm just a reflection of the sun's light. I won't be seen. To which Hashem said, you're right. In the end, Hashem appeased the moon by allowing it to be escorted by the train of stars to make it feel better. But again, gentlemen, the problem is quite obvious, and that is that we're having a very graphic discussion that seems to attribute real emotions, real feelings, real conscious thought to an inanimate object. And the question is, what's pshat? What is going on? What does the Gemara mean to teach us? And to understand this Gemara, I'd like to take a little bit of a step away for a moment to a different area. When I was a child, I remember very vividly that my father brought my brother and myself to my grandfather. And when my father brought us that time, he said something about the fact that what we're going to do now doesn't work, but we're going to do it anyway. My father and my grandfather lie on his stomach, and he put bankis on my grandfather. If you were born in this country, you likely don't know what bankis is. Bankis are little glass cups. You take this glass cup and you put it near the skin of the sick person. You put a candle right under the cup. The candle, because it burns the oxygen, effectively creates a vacuum. When you get a good vacuum, you put the bankis, you put the cup down on the skin, and it draws up the skin into this little glass. You lay maybe 20 of these on the patient. You leave it for a while, and then you take them off. Now, the reason why my father did put bankis on my grandfather was, as he explained to us, there's a mitzvah called kibirav. The reason why my grandfather asked my father to put bankis on him was because my grandfather was born in Poland. And in Poland, there was a very clear understanding that man had for thousands of years. And that understanding is that most illnesses come from humors, from bad airs. And what you have to do is you have to draw up the bad air. And when you draw up the bad air, the patient becomes cured. Now, the truth be told, it wouldn't shock me totally if there isn't some medicinal effect of this. But the bottom line is, we now understand that very little of illness have to do with bad airs, humors, or any of these things. But for hundreds, literally thousands of years, mankind did not know that. In 1847, there was a physician, Ignaz Semmelweis. He was a young physician, and he noticed something, that the women who would come to his hospital to give birth, 1/6 of them died in childbirth. Now, while that number was phenomenally high, what was interesting was that there was a hospital very close nearby that only had, instead of doctors, had midwives delivering the babies. And in that hospital, only 2% of the women died in childbirth. And this Ignaz Semmelweis could not understand it. So he racked his brain and he thought and he read all of the medical literature available at the time, and there was nothing that could explain it. He studied and he studied and he watched the procedures and watched the procedures. Finally, he came up with a theory. You see, the doctors would go from dissecting the cadavers, the dead bodies, directly from there to the maternity section and deliver the babies without washing their hands. And he said to himself, maybe there's something that's emitted from the dead bodies, and he instituted a new procedure to scrub your hands, to wash your hands before delivering. And once he instituted that in the hospital, the mortality rate dropped to 1%. You would assume that after making this great discovery, he'd be honored as a hero. Very quickly, when he realized that there was something here, and he explained it to the other doctors, and especially the head of medicine in that hospital, he was asked to leave because he was clearly losing it. Not only was he asked to leave, he began lecturing that there's something we can't see, there's something we don't know what it is, but we have to wash our hands, etc. He was thrown out of Vienna. In the end, he ended up in a mental institution where he died because he was propagating this wild theory that there are unknown, unseen things that infect people and kill them. In 1865, when the Civil War ended, 50% of the casualties, 50% of the soldiers who were injured died, not because of the injuries, but because of infections. Because no one knew that there was something called bacteria, something called viruses, something called microbes. And patients would die left and right. In the late 1860s, early 1870s, a fellow called Louis Pasteur came about with this new theory. It was called the germ theory. His theory was that there were these untold millions and millions of germs that you couldn't see, but they would infect a patient. They would get into the body, they begin doubling and redoubling, and that's what kills your patients. Now, when Louis Pasteur, by the way, when you drink pasteurized milk, that's because it was named after Louis Pasteur, because by boiling the milk, they kill the germs. He began explaining to people that these germs, you have to deal with them. You have to scrub your hands, you have to boil your medical instruments. You can't do these things. As soon as he began preaching his new theory, he too received the same sort of welcome as did Semmelweis. He was, first off, thrown out of various hospitals. Eventually, the Emperor of France exiled him, threw him out of France because of his ridiculous and absurd fantasies. And they mocked him for years and years. If you hear the way they described him, oh, Dr. Pasteur, there are bugs and germs and they're floating. And don't tell me, when I breathe out millions of these disease bugs. Oh, and how do we cure it? Oh, we take other bugs and put it into the person. My friends, when he first invented the rabies vaccine, you have to understand what the people thought of him. What he was taking was dead or partly dead vaccines, putting it into the body with the understanding that the immune system of the human body would fight against it. People laughed at him, mocked him, and for years and years they did not accept his findings until eventually when he cured that young fellow of rabies, and then he went on to fame. Now, if you were to ask a scientist in the 1840s, in the 1850s, about this concept of germ theories, microbes, they would have laughed at you, well, we're going to wear masks, we're going to boil our instruments, and it was an absurdity. But the reality is that what they could not fathom or imagine, what to them was a fantastical world of impossibility, is reality. Says the Rambam in Hilchos Yesodei Torah Perek Beis, Shinui Shemos HaMalachim, the different names to the Malachim, Al Shem Malosam, is on the basis of their different status. Says the Rambam, there are 10 names to the different categories of Malachim, because they are very distinct, each one on a very distinct level. The highest level on the Chayas HaKodesh. Below them are the Ofanim, the Arelim, the Chashmelim, the Srafim, the Malachim. The lowest level, the 10th level of Malachim, are the Malachim called Elohim. Why do they have these names, the B'nai Elohim? Finally, I'm sorry, the lowest level is the Ishim. The Ishim are the ones who take on human form. If you've ever heard, if you read in Nevi'im about a Malach taking on a human form, that's only the lowest level of Malach, because only such a Malach can show itself in human form. The other Malachim are far too high, far too holy to do that. In fact, when Chana saw the Malach, and Elkanah assumed that they were going to die, it was the lowest form of Malach that they mistook for Hashem. Because a powerful creature called a Malach is something that's so beyond human understanding. But not only do Malachim exist, not only are there many different levels and katim in various groups, the Chovos Levavos says a very interesting point. He says that you should understand that everything physical must have a spiritual counterpart. If you find a particle of physicality, there is a spiritual counterpart to it, just like the guf has a neshama, and the neshama has a guf, so too any physical manifestation has a spiritual counterpart to it. But here's the next level where things get very interesting. Says the Rambam as follows. Kol ha-kochavim v'al-gilgolim, all of the stars and the constellations, kulam bali nefesh v'deya, each one of them is a bal nefesh, has a soul, has a consciousness, and has wisdom. V'im chayim v'omdim, they stand and recognize Hashem. This spiritual counterpart of stars and constellations is greater than man's neshama, but lower than a malach, and is a das nifrad, is a separate conscious understanding. And gentlemen, if you'd like to know what Chazal meant when they said that the moon was jealous, it was not the lunar craters, But keneged, opposite the moon, there is a spiritual counterpart which is greater than the neshama of man, lower than a malach, but it's a das nifrat. It's a consciousness, it's an intelligence with its own agenda, its own interests, its own agenda, its thinking, it's a consciousness, and it had a taina. Its claim against Hashem was very simple. Is it proper for two kings to wear one crown? We can't both be the great Shnei Hamaoros. Whilst the claim was legitimate, Hashem said, you are the one who spoke, therefore go mimamai yourself. And Hashem recognized that that malach, that das, that intellect, felt badly, and Hashem wanted to appease it. But I think it doesn't really end here. If you study Bereishis, I think you'll find some very eye-opening examples of things that are very, very unfamiliar to Western thought. Listen to what the pasuk says. Matotze aretz desha esev mazria zera. The land brought forth grass, mazria zera lemineu, with seeds in accordance to its type. The problem is that the pasuk seems to be saying that the land brought forth grass. Says Rashi, quoting a Gemara, that is accurate. But not only is it accurate, the land did something differently than what Hashem told it to do. You see, Hashem told the grass to bring forth, told the ground, I'm sorry, to bring forth grass, that the grass should not just be grass, but should have a seed. But Hashem did not tell the ground to bring forth grass with a seed that brings forth the next generation identical to it. Hashem just said, ground, bring forth grass with a seed. If you plant Kentucky bluegrass in this region, the next generation will be identical. That is something that the land did on its own. Because the Gemara in Chulin says that the land made a kal vachomer. If Hashem told the trees to bring forth a tree with seeds that imitate exactly the parent, trees which are distinct and separate, Hashem wanted each one to carry on a seed with exact format, the parent to the child, surely the grass said, surely grass which is not as distinct should be separate. So the land made this kal vachomer and brought forth grass, each one with a zera for its min that Hashem did not tell it to do. How is that possible? It's not the blade of grass, it's the sar, it's the malach of the ground that Hashem commanded to bring forth this grass, and the grass brought it forth. But it doesn't really end there. It gets even more interesting when you hear that there are certain particles of creation, certain parts of creation, that don't listen to Hashem. The pasuk says, "V'totzei aretz desha esev mazria zera lemineu." The land brought forth the esev, the grass, in a right way, but it didn't do the same for the tree. Because when Hashem commanded the land to bring forth trees, Hashem commanded that the tree should have the taste of the fruit. That the apple tree should have a taste in the wood, the very similar taste to the apple. But that's not what the land did. The land brought forth a tree with wood and only an apple that had that flavor. And says the Gemara, because the land didn't listen to Hashem, the land was punished. But there's one more step. The Pasuk says in Bereishis, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Vayomer Lakim, Hashem said, Yeshutsu Amayim Sheretz Nefesh Chaya, let the water bring forth reptiles. The creeping creatures should be brought forth from the water. And says Rashi, that is literal. Meaning, Rashi explains, that the water was to bring forth the creeping reptiles, the guf. Hashem was to insert the neshama, and a combination of the two, Hashem and the water, was to create all of the iguanas, crocodiles, and snakes that you see in front of you. Now, gentlemen, I believe that this is a very advanced and very sophisticated concept. And that concept is that when Hashem created the world, there are many, many dimensions to this world. When I look at a piece of wood, I see a solid, inanimate object. But with a microscope, I see a whole other world. If I have an electron microscope, I see atoms, maybe I even see movement. I see at the core of an atom, I see an electron, and I see electrons spinning around. I see movement. Certainly, I see microbes, I see bacterias, I see whole other worlds that the naked eye doesn't see. And just like there are worlds that are unseen in the physical world, in the spiritual world as well, there are untold and unseen worlds. But they're real. The moon has a counterpart, a spiritual counterpart of Malach. So too does the ground. So too does the water. And Hashem commanded those to do certain things, but they're a das nifrad. They are a separate intellect. They have their own agenda, their own interests. They might listen, they might not listen. In the case of the land was later punished because it didn't listen. It listened with the grass and it said a kal vachomer, but there are times when it did, times when it didn't. And you may say to me, this is interesting, but is this mainstream Judaism? I mean, like, do we all believe in this? This may be the Westchester Kabbalah Center, regular Orthodox Jews believe this stuff? Gentlemen, let me just quote. You pay attention to davening. From Baruch Hu till Shema, you'll see some amazing words. Kulam omdim brum olam, all of them stand in the heights of the world, umashmim beyira, and open their mouths with great fear, yachad bekol, together in voice, divrei Elokim chayim umelech olam, the words of Hashem live, and He is the King forever. Kulam ahuvim, kulam berurim, kulam giborim, you'll hear a very long and graphic description of the avoda that the malachim do on a daily basis. And if you pay attention to the words, you'll hear a description of what happens in Shemayim. Kulam poskim es piyam, all of them open their mouth, bekdusha v'tara, with great holiness and purity. And they say the various shira, kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. And right after that, listen to these words. V'ofanim v'chayas hakodesh. Remember the Rambam told us there are 10 levels of malachim? The davening, which is written by Anshei Knesset Gedolah, begins quoting the various groups of Malachim, the Ofanim and the Chayas HaKodesh, with a loud voice. Misnasim raised himself, Lumas Serafim, opposite to the Serafim, a different group of Malachim, and they all sing out together, Baruch Kavod Hashem Mim Kamo. And I believe that there is one very, very important principle that we have to gain from this. And that is understanding the glory of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The glory of the Shekhinah. And I'll explain to you what I mean. Most Americans claim to believe in God. As a matter of fact, the vast majority of Americans claim to believe in a deity, in God. And I claim that the vast majority of those people are practicing atheists. And I'll explain to you what I mean. A number of years ago, when my oldest daughter was 14, she became, lo aleinu, a Yankee fan. Well, that became a big thing in the family. You know, everybody was into it, so I took the kids to a Yankee game, and the family as a whole became Yankee fans. And it got to the point where when we'd be driving in the van and we'd pass Yankee Stadium, everybody would clap, yay! And then one time it was the Subway Series, we passed Shea Stadium, and everybody in the car was going, boo! And my seven-year-old daughter's going, boo, boo, boo. One of the other kids said to my seven-year-old daughter, why are you booing? So what do you mean? We're passing Shea Stadium. That's the Mets. They're the bad guys. But you see, the problem was she had never witnessed a baseball game, didn't know what a glove looked like. I'm not sure she knew what a bat was, and she had never, ever seen anybody playing baseball. But she knew that the Yankees were good, the Mets were bad, but she didn't have a clue to what they were. And gentlemen, I believe that many, many people who claim to believe in God or would say we're God-fearing don't have a clue. Where is God? Well, I don't know where God is. I mean, it must be millions of miles away. I mean, don't give me that stuff about God being involved in my life and intimately involved in things and decisions in this world and what happens. Come on, don't get me nervous about that stuff. God's way, way up in heaven, far away, doing those God things that God's supposed to do, right? You know, like, don't get me nervous with all that talk about divine intervention. My friends, most people who say those words are practicing atheists because they don't understand that Hashem is the creator, maintainer, and orchestrator of this world. And that is the basis of Emunah. But listen to what the Gemara in Chulin says. The Gemara in Tzichonin says that each day there are three separate huge, huge groups of malachim that are created. Each day there are three separate groups of malachim created to say kadosh. But why are the three groups created? Because you need an entire army of malachim to say kadosh, but it's not proper and fitting for that group to say more than one word of kadosh. That group can't say twice kadosh, so you have to create a second group, second army of malachim to say the second kadosh, and a third for the third word. Each day, entire groups of malachim are created. Says the Gemara, there are many malachim that only get to say Shirat Hashem once a day. Many malachim will only get to praise Hashem once a week. Many malachim that only get to praise Hashem once a month. Many once a year. Many once every 7 years. Many once every 50 years. There are many, many malachim that get to sing Shir V'Shevach to Hashem once in their lifetime, and that is it. And you know why that is? Because the glory and the honor due to Hashem is so beyond our understanding that it is fit and proper to have huge armies of malachim getting up there and saying kadosh, but not kadosh, kadosh. You can't say two of those words because the honor and glory due to Hashem is so great that it's not befitting, it's not proper covered to utter more than one statement. And you were here 500 years ago, Malach, you were here. You don't belong here again. And that is the honor and kavod due to Hashem. And gentlemen, I have one very important observation to make. If I speak into a tape recorder and I say the words kadosh, 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 and I make a copy of that tape, and another copy, and another copy, and I set up 10,000 tape recorders, there is very little honor or glory to Hashem in the 10,000 tape recorders playing that song. But that is not the avodah that happens in Shemayim. Each malach is a separate entity with a separate consciousness, with a separate mindset, with a separate agenda, a das nifrad, separate from Hashem. Each malach has bechira, has free will. The difference between a malach and an adam is not free will. The difference is the clarity of understanding. What a malach sees with total, absolute clarity is the fact that there's no particle of physicality that could exist without a spiritual counterpart, and there's no particle of physicality or spirituality that can exist without Hashem holding it in existence, keeping it there. And so a malach sees Hashem with total clarity, and a malach wishes and desires with a great hunger to sing out praise to its creator because it recognizes the honor due to Hashem. And then that very Gemara says something amazing. Says the Gemara, from here we see how much greater Adam, how much greater a Jew is than a malach, because at any time a Jew can say kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. Not one word, three words, not once every 50 years, any time, three times a day minimum, a Jew can say that. Says the Gemara, you see the mind-boggling power of a Jew. And unfortunately, we usually miss it. We usually miss the impact of what those words mean, what they say. But that's what a person has to come to understand, the glory due, the effect of those words, and what happens when I say it. But I think there's another interesting and important lesson to be learned from this whole issue. And that's something that the Gemara in Chulin Daf Tzadik Aleph Amid Beis brings out. It says the Gemara, when Yaakov Avinu ran away from Esav, he lied down to rest. Vayikach me'avnei amokom, he took from the stones of that place. He took the many, many stones, gathered them together, and he rested his head upon it. But the problem is that he rested to sleep on the many stones, but when he got up in the morning, the pasuk says, Vayikach es ha'evin, he took the single stone. He lied down on many, got up on one. Amar Reb Yitzchak says, Melamed shen eskabtzu kol osam avonim. This teaches us that all of those rocks gathered together, l'mokom echad, to one place. Kol echad ve'echad omeres ish rak said, alai yanich tzadik es rosho, on me let the tzadik place his head. And they formed a unit. The many rocks became one rock because they so desired, they so wished to be under the head of a tzaddik. Says the Mishnah Sharm, this Gemara is actually teaching us a fundamental lesson. And that lesson is that any part of this world that a Jew uses, he affects. If a Jew uses a seat for a proper and holy purpose, that chair changes. It becomes a more holy entity. If a person uses this world for its proper purpose, that part of this world that he uses is changed, is different, and it leaves a roshim. On the flip side, if a person uses his world improperly, it's not just that he did something improper, it's not just that he put something in the world, he changed that part of physicality. The spiritual counterpart of that physicality is now weakened, is now degraded, and he changed the world. But there's one more step that I want to focus on. In almost every machzor that you'll find, there's a little tefillah that we say when they blow the shofar. And the words of that tefillah basically go something like, Yirotzom afanecha, it should be the will in front of your Hashem, that the malachim that come out of the shofar should be olal afanecha l'rotzom. The malachim that come out of the shofar should go in front of you and be well received. Now, gentlemen, I guarantee, stare as hard as you like, all day long Rosh Hashanah, you will not see malachim emitting from that shofar. But the Gemara tells us, and it is something that's brought in many, many places, that it's not just ki a shofar. Any mitzvah that a Jew does creates a malach. If I put on tefillin, if I pick up a lulav and esrog, if I put a mezuzah on my door, that creates a malach, a separate new spiritual creation that exists. And the Chafetz Chaim says something very interesting. Chafetz Chaim says at the end of a man's days, he is surrounded by huge, huge armies of malachim. He's surrounded by the malachim that he created during his lifetime. And says the Chafetz Chaim, many of those malachim are powerful creatures, powerful creations that are pure and beautiful. And then there's some malachim that are not quite so powerful, don't shine quite as bright. And there's some malachim that are damaged, some that are crippled, some that are ugly. Because when you do an action, what you're thinking, your intentions while you're doing that action, greatly impact that action. So that if you do an action with the right kavanah, with the right intention, you create a powerful, beautiful, sterling malach. But if you do that very same action with arrogance, the very same action with selfishness, the very same action with a wrong intention, that malach that's emitted is different, is changed, maybe even ugly. And at the end of a man's days, he's surrounded by huge, huge armies of malachim for what he did on the good, many pure, some not so pure, and what he did on the bad also creates a malach. And there are many, many malachim on both sides. You and I don't see this. We don't see the spiritual counterpart to a table. We don't see the fact that when we speak Divrei Torah, we create a malach. But that's okay. Because for thousands of years, man was ignorant, completely ignorant to a whole world. Microbes were unknown. Louis Pasteur was mocked. Semmelweis was not just made fun of, he ended up in an insane asylum because he propagated, he talked about this fanciful world, this whole world. And gentlemen, I want you to hear well what I'm saying here. If you open a copy of the New York Times, you should properly be amazed at the wisdom that modern man has. And when you read it cover to cover, you should be astounded by the amazing discoveries and tremendous, tremendous wisdom manifest. And if you're not really moved, open the Tuesday Science section, and you'll see whole worlds brought forth right in front of you. And you also have to be fully aware that the brilliance, the wisdom of such man is also blind. Because while modern man is very, very keenly aware of certain elements of this creation, he is also blind as a bat to an entire other dimension. The entire dimension of ruchnius, of spirituality, Western man is ignorant of. Blindly ignorant. And when you hear Chazal describe these things, you have to say to yourself, wow, did I miss the boat? When Chazal describe a moon claiming it's not right, Hashem, you're doing something improper, and Hashem has a conversation with the moon back and forth, and Hashem says to the moon, you're right, I feel badly because you're not getting the proper covenant, I have to make you smaller. And then when you hear about the earth bringing forth grass, doing it in a way that Hashem didn't command it, but then the earth being punished because it did, what you're hearing is a description of something that Western man is completely oblivious to. But it's a part of reality, it's a part of the world, and it's a part of something that we have to become attuned to and aware of. And there are two major effects. Number one for me to understand what it means that I, little me, am standing in front of my Creator. You know, when you read the way people talk about God, you know, me and God, we're equals, you know, we're buddies. I mean, sometimes I like God, sometimes I don't like God, sometimes I put up with Him, sometimes I get a little bit ticked at God, and I'm not even sure I really believe in Him anyway. Your hair on the back of your neck should be bristling, you should feel fire in your heart, the chutzpah, the audacity to talk about the Creator of the heavens and the earth. You little minuscule peon, you nothing. You're at one of 6 billion tiny, tiny ants that occupy this planet. Hashem created not just this planet, but 100 billion stars. And that's just one galaxy amongst 100 billion galaxies. And you and God are equals. But we, living in a tactile, physical world, are ignorant of the glory of Hashem. But when you hear about huge, huge groups of malachim, entire armies, who get to say the word Kadosh once every 500 years, and that's the honor due, you begin to get an eye glimpse as to the honor and glory due to our Creator. And that's very important for us to remember and understand. But the second lesson, I think, is also equally important. And that second lesson is that when I walk on this planet, I can do something that the greatest malach in the world can never dream of doing. I can change this world. My actions, my thoughts, my words change the physicality, the spirituality of this world. This table is a different table. The chair is a different chair. When I do what I'm supposed to, the world itself is elevated. And when I do the opposite, it's lowered. No malach, no birya, nothing in this creation can do that. Only Adam. And the keys to creation were given to man. Man and man alone. And when you hear that and you understand that, it changes radically the whole way you treat yourself. The whole way you view yourself. The whole way you view your interactions with others. The whole way you view your entire existence. And a big part of the problem that we have with Avodas Hashem is that we think like a Western man. We think like a guy. We see physicality. Physicality is real and nothing else exists. And so we're blind. And like those doctors that mocked Louis Pasteur, that made up, taunted him because they thought was inventing worlds, we unfortunately are completely ignorant to the entire dimension of ruchnius, of spirituality, and we have to wake up and understand it, and hear from Chazal descriptions, and hear from Chazal what happens in Shemayim. And I highly recommend, pay attention during davening. Listen during the words of Kedusha, Nekadesh et Shimcha. May we glorify your name, Kishem Shemakdishim Oso Bishmei Morom, as they glorify your name up in Shemayim. Listen to the words, Yehei Shmei Rabba. Listen to those words. Know and understand that much of Tefillah describes the shir v'shevach, the praise that happened in Shemayim, because we're supposed to understand that, because we're supposed to be able to do more than that, and that's part of our job as a Jew. I want to close with one observation. For a good number of years now, I've tried not to speak when I'm wearing tefillin. And the reason why I do this is not because I'm so frum or anything like that. In fact, I try not even to speak Divrei Torah when I'm wearing tefillin. The reason why I do this sort of just kind of evolved one day when I came to an interesting realization. We, living in this country, have many, many riches. And many of us have possessions, fine possessions, and we take very good care of our fine possessions. We put them in special places. We're very careful with them. Gentlemen, unless you own a Sefer Torah, the most holy possession that you have is your tefillin. Far more holy than any sefer, far more holy than a mezuzah. Tefillin are a davar shebekedusha. You can make a shvuas Hashem holding it. It is a very, very holy object, arguably the most holy object you own. Well, here's the observation. When you wear those tefillin affect you, but you also affect them. When you wear the tefillin, it affects your ruchnius level, but just like any particle of this physical world that has a spiritual counterpart that's changed based on how a man uses it, your tefillin are changed based on how you use them. Now don't get me wrong, you can't possible them. No matter what you think, no matter what type of crazy thought, if you had a thought of apikorsis when you're wearing it, you can't possible the tefillin. They're still holy, but you change them. What you think when you're wearing them changes the tefillin. And one day when I came home, I said to myself, idiot that I am. I've invested well over 20 years into these tefillin. I'm just going to leave them on the dining room table. This is by far my most prized possession. If I had brains in my head, I'd buy a safe and put them in the wall safe, because this is by far my most valuable possession. And that understanding that the tefillin affect me, but I affect them, is a very important one to understand. Because that concept helps us understand exactly who we are and exactly what we do. I'm not just a guy. I'm not just whatever, another occupant of this planet. When Hashem created me, Hashem put me on this planet to do, to accomplish, and Hashem put huge amounts of opportunities in front of me to make this world into a different world, to change the ruchnius level of this world. I don't see it. I'm blind as a bat. Yeah, but I'm also blind as a bat to microbes and viruses, but they exist, and so too this part exists. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu allow us to understand and see this entire world that we don't see. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu allow us to understand the impact of human beings' actions and thoughts.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozin free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.